meeting is being recorded.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome. We are once again back to the Parashat Shiurim after my break. We're not doing the Parashat for the next couple of weeks. Instead, we're going to be focusing on Megillat Eicha, the Megillah that we read on Tisha B'Av. The strange kind of timings of things have been that we had four Parashat Shiurim in a row focusing on Megillat Rut in preparation for Shavuot, and due to various scheduling whatnots, we probably only had, I think, a couple of weeks where we actually focused on the Parashah until once again we've switched once again to Eicha. But the truth is, Eichas are really, really interesting Megillah. Not in the same way Rut is, or in the same way Esther is, because, you know, Esther and Rut are their stories, their narratives, and there's a lot to kind of glean from those narratives just by analyzing, you know, doing the classic, let's look at the story a little more closely, is actually everything we think going on actually going on, or all of the kind of the classic things we do. Eicha doesn't have a story. The value of Eicha lies not in its story, but in the fact that Eicha is the probably the most clearly crafted work of biblical poetry that we have. And there are a lot of non-real comparisons between Esther and Eicha. My favorite, I've probably mentioned it before in some context or another, the tune, the distinctive tune for Eicha is the same distinctive tune that we read for Megillat Esther, just Esther is the major key and Eicha is the minor key. But there, it's actually the same tune. And what's really interesting is if you hear, I was once in a shul where this happened, if someone with a really, really nice voice does Eicha, it can very easily start sounding like Megillat Esther. And likewise, if someone's a little bit low and dirgy when they read Megillat Esther, it can all too easily sound far too similar to Eicha. But the other non-comparison that's a comparison is if Esther is the most carefully crafted, most meticulously crafted narrative in Tanakh, which I think it is, Eicha's, it's parallel when it comes to poetry. But what that means is for the next couple of weeks, when it comes to appreciating Eicha, I don't really want to focus on, well, there's no narrative to point out. Eicha describes the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. But what I want to point out over the next couple of weeks are some of the poetic features of Eicha. And something that I will say I never really appreciated during my, you know, years of schooling is when you take kind of the English literature class and your kind of poetic things are pointed out to you. Not really my jam, I'll be honest. But the truth is, it's something that we need to have a slight awareness of when it comes to biblical texts, because they use poetry. You know, Eicha is, if you want to convey a mood, which is what Eicha is designed to do, the whole point of Eicha is not its content per se, but the mood it creates. That when we are sat on Tisha B'Av night, and fine, we'll start to hear that, you know, the distinctive Eicha Yashva Havadad, and it's just instantly depressing, plus the general atmosphere of the room, low lighting, sat on the floor, everything. But the problem basically becomes, and I speak for myself, but I assume it's pretty universal, we're not really focusing on the content of Eicha at that point. Maybe we're reading it in the English, but the problem with reading poetry is that it's still poetry, and there's only so much it can kind of convey. And so, in order to prepare myself to better appreciate Eicha this year, I tried to focus a little bit more on some of the poetic ideas that are coming out of Eicha, so that on that Motzei Shabbat that's going to be Tisha B'Av, August 6th, I think it translates to, there's slightly more things to notice and appreciate. And so this is kind of going to be a little bit of a maybe a crash course and a few different examples of biblical poetry, grammar, all those fun things. Sometimes things I like to point out also in the parasha, Eicha has those in spades. And I'm gonna share the source sheet at this point. We're going back to the good old-fashioned screen share for this. So at this point, hopefully you can see the Sfaria source sheet. And the first example that I want to share with you, and I'll say something that I observed when preparing this share and learning this for myself. There's something kind of cool that good translations of Eicha do, which is that they take biblical poetic things and they find their analog in English. So obviously, this should go without saying, the way the familiar beats of poetry to us as English readers are not going to be the same as in another language. It doesn't always work like that. Things that for us are features of poetry are not always going to be features of poetry in another language. That's just basically the way it works. So how do you get around that? You translate the terms using alternative poetic ideas. To explain this a little bit better, take a look at the first two sources that I put on. So if you just look, first of all, in English, if you look at the first source, English ends, he has increased within fair Judah, mourning and moaning. Alliteration, classic, as people know who listen to my trash art, I love a good amount of alliteration. Sometimes I overdo it. In the second source, which is from chapter 3 of Eicha, panic and pitfall are our lot. Classic English language poetic alliteration. We spot that straight away. Mourning and moaning. I mean, it also rhymes, which is even better in this particular case. Panic and pitfall. You read that in the English and you're like, that's poetry. That's a thing. In Hebrew, what's really interesting is if you look, we see something slightly different. So if you look again now on the Hebrew, I bolded it. This verse ends, verse 5 of chapter 2 ends, Vayerev bevat Yehuda ta'aniya va'aniya. That isn't alliterative, but it's a complete rhyme. Ta'aniya va'aniya. Those are two different words. But they are being formed into this perfect kind of, it's like the opposite of alliteration. The one thing that is constant in alliteration in English is the first letter. In Hebrew, you get aniya on both ta aniya va aniya being this mourning and moaning being the English equivalent. Similarly, in the second verse on the source sheet, verse 47 of chapter 3, panic and pitfall are pachad va-pachat, which is, again, there it's two different words, but it's been two different words chosen that are exactly the same, save their final letter, and that final letter changes anything. Panic, pachad is literally fear, but obviously panic is a better poetic translation, but pachad va-pachat, again, it's a perfect example of this poetry in the Hebrew. On Tisha B'Av night, when we listen to someone reading Ta'aniya Va'aniya, so first of all, and I say this as one of the Eicha readers, it's really, really difficult when you are reading a Megillah. Let's even assume you have practiced it in advance, which with Eicha, you've probably not really given it much of a look over because you're reading it from the text itself, so you're reading it on sight. One of the things, I also notice this sometimes on rare occasions when I am leading Slichot in the run-up to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, Slichot love a good rhyme, right? Rhyming in Hebrew, by the way, is really easy because often the final syllable of a Hebrew word is the same because of its tense, gender, all those sorts of things. Rhyming schemes in Hebrew, you'll notice they're everywhere and they're less fancy because they're really, really easy to do. If you make everything, not a grammarian, don't know the actual term, but if you make everything, a plural, feminine, past tense, whatever, it will always rhyme. So it's kind of, that's how you do it. But when you read, when sometimes I find this when I'm doing slichot also, I pick up on the rhyming scheme and I'm trying to read it to hit that rhyme. So like every single ending syllable of each line ends the same way to kind of emphasize this is rhyming, because the English, when you're following along the English, you don't get the rhyming. But when you're reading Eicha 2, whoever's reading chapter 2, and I did get the list of it earlier today, but whoever's reading chapter 2, when they get to, you know, Vayare Bavad Yehuda, Ta'aniya, Va'aniya, it requires a certain level of to spot all of these. Pachad V'Pachat is even harder to notice. Oh, it's a rhyme, because it's instinctively, or it's not a rhyme, but it's a biblical alliteration thingy bob. It's much harder to notice those things. So in an ideal world, those of us reading Eicha would be perfectly able to grasp all of these poetic forms and all the rest, but realistically, you know, it's not going to happen. But hopefully by looking at it in advance, we can appreciate it a little better. Not everything Eicha does is in its poetic form. The most powerful parts of Eicha, and here again, the English is actually good enough to just focus on here. But if we, first of all, obviously the visuals. Eicha paints a really, really depressing picture. Obviously, that's its job. Its job is to get us into the mood. And so we have, it's just loaded with, again, the problem is, again, even poetic English doesn't necessarily instinctively create the, you know, a certain image in our head, and maybe as easily as narrative will. But you get a lot of examples of a visual. So, you know, just in English, the foe has laid hands on everything dear to her. She has seen her sanctuary invaded by nations which you have denied admission into your community. We get this image of, you know, an invasion force. You can picture in your head at that point swarms of a foreign army entering into the Beit HaMikdash. By the way, something just to notice about the translation Sfarier is using here, you'll notice a lot of capitalization. That's because the English translation is translating it like a poem. So wherever you see an unnecessary capital, that's the next line of the poem, but here it forces it just into sentences. Again, we get another really powerful image. Chapter 2 is really, really image heavy. But, you know, silence sit on the ground, the elders of Fair Tzion, they have strewn dust on their heads and girded themselves with sackcloth. So again, just straight away, we have this image of the most respected members of Yerushalayim just sat mourning. The maidens of Yerushalayim have bowed their heads to the ground. My eyes are spent with tears. My heart is in tumult. My being melts away over the ruin of my poor people as babes and sucklings languish in the squares of the city. That is, Eicha hits us over and over again with the most traumatic image, which is starving children and starving people. You know, I didn't put it on the source sheet, but the most famous traumatic message of Eicha is people eating their own children for food, which, again, Eicha doesn't pull its punches because it's Eicha. It's supposed to get us into, you know, much in the same way, you know, in the modern day, you watch a movie about the Holocaust. They don't pull their punches because the whole point is it's conveying the horror of that world. And so to hear Eicha is, it's just, its imagery is, you know, intense. Again, verse 8 of chapter 4, now their faces are blacker than soot. They are not recognized in the streets. Their skin has shriveled on their bones. It has become dry of wood. Again, you picture this gaunt, starved, you know, just covered in dirt person roaming the streets. Eicha telegraphs the mood of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. It's very, very explicit in the visual that it gives you. You don't have to think hard in order to conjure the visuals of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, the horror. This is why, you know, it's very, very popular. It's been very, very popular now, obviously, for many, many decades to lean hard into into the Holocaust on Tisha B'Av. And part of that is to create a, it is hard for us to relate to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, but at the same time, we're looking for, we know we need to feel sad on Tisha B'Av. We want to have that sense of trauma being experienced. And so we look at our most recent, you know, national trauma in order to create that same mood. But Eicher is doing that exact same thing, just with biblical poetry. But we don't just get visuals. And this is actually what's really powerful about Eicher, is Eicher also gives us sounds. So we get, for instance, the second verse of Eicher, Bacho tivka balayla. She weeps in the night. Yerushalayim weeps, her cheeks wet with tears. We're not supposed to just, you know, see, this is an anthropomorphization of Yerushalayim, but we're not just supposed to see tears, but we're supposed to, we're hearing crying at that point. That's the power of this verse. Similarly, when we're reading about the army swarming to Yerushalayim, you know, in verse 7 of chapter 2, Zanach, Adnaim is Bacho, Ni'er Mikdasho, his God has rejected his altar, Heskir Biad Oyev, Chomot Armanotaha, he's handed over to the foes, the walls of Yerushalayim. Kol Natnu Beveit Adonai Kiyom Moe, they are shouting rejoiously, like a fat festival, as we're reading the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. We're not just seeing these contrasting visuals of the Jewish people, you know, traumatized, being destroyed, being murdered, and the army swarming in. But it's in a world without movies, in a world without audio, you know, I mean, obviously we're used to books too, but we have to paint the sound at the same time. And, you know, if you're reading something I've been doing while in quarantine is rereading a bunch of Harry Potter books. And Harry Potter is phenomenally well written. And it's one of those brilliant books that you hear the sounds. Like, it's one of those things, like a good book, you don't just picture the scene, but you hear the noises at the same time. You think you're kind of almost there watching it at the same time. Lahavdil, and for far different purposes, but Eicher's, we hear the army's joyous shout. And again, that idea, Kiyom Moed, as on a festival, obviously for us, we don't know what the Beit HaMikdash sounded like on a festival. We don't know that joyous sound, but nonetheless, we've all seen enough kind of medieval war movies to be able to picture these sounds, but there is celebration. We hear the joy of the army as they are coming in to destroy everyone. And so as we're listening to Eicher, we're not just ideally being transported into a visual, but we can also hear the sounds of what's being described. Again, chapter 2 is full of this. And so again, we get the children. The children are asking their mothers, where is the bread and wine? Like behit at fam kechalal berchovot ir, as they languish like battle wounded, as they're dying. It's not simply, again, it's an extra level of trauma. Like the imagery is extra powerful. It's one thing, it's bad enough to read these children are starving. It's another thing to hear what they are saying. You read. Verse 12, I remember, I may talk about this another time in a different context. I remember growing up, going to a shul where they were reading Eicher, and literally there's a guy who knew what was being read, and he's just like crying. Because if you understand the Hebrew, or you're following along almost synchronized with the English, as opposed to like skimming it or reading it ahead, and you're immersed in Eicher, you can't reach a verse like verse 12 of chapter 2 and not, and remember, we already looked at 10 and 11. So this is all the child imagery. And now not only have you just like, you know, in verses 10 and 11, you've witnessed the scene, but now you hear what they are saying. And if you're like me and you don't, you always kind of skip or you walk out of the room during movies when they start to get really, really sad because you just, you can't, you know, you don't like it. You know, Eicha does that also. It's imagery. It doesn't pull its punches and it's really on the nose and explicit in how it does it. Again, just one more example of the sound. Patsu alaych bihem kol oivayich sharkuve vay charkushen. They jeer at you and they gnash their teeth. They cry amrubil anu. We've ruined her again. This is the army, so we hear their joy, but like they hiss and they sharku. They hiss vay charkushen. They gnash their teeth. Those are very You see those words in English, you know, a hiss, a gnash of teeth. It's not just a visual, it's a sound, it's a complete image. And even when we read about, for example, in verse 5 of chapter 4, that the people who used to live at large, chibku ashbatot, they've embraced kind of the garbage dumps, the refuse heaps. We get a few different references to kind of public, you know, just like garbage everywhere, you know, the horrors of that kind of experience. And there's almost, again, you can almost smell it. You have the sights, you have the sounds, but then you also, again, Eicha over time just really telegraphs the stench of the experience. We have refuse heaps. We have obviously, you know, rotting corpses. It really, really paints, you know, a really intense picture in order to convey its message. So the most kind of extreme form Eicha takes is with, as I scroll up, this imagery. First of all, literally the visuals it paints, but it also gives us the sounds and maybe even some, you know, smells of the experience. It's really, again, it's not a cold historical description of events. It's an emotional retelling of the experience. And in a sense, if you read Eicha the way it's intending itself to be read, you witness the destruction happening before your very eyes. You are immersed in what is going on. So much so that, again, you know, there's nothing better on the Shabbos afternoon before Tisha B'Av, when there's not really much else you can do at that point, to read Eicha in advance, slowly, you know, in a good English translation, to really get a sense of the horrors that it's describing. The one other thing that's really interesting that Eicha does, that I want to focus on today, is its use of metaphor. And the metaphor of Eicha is very simple. And in the 21st century, in the year 2022, it's not necessarily a metaphor. I'll put it this way. If a book were to do this in the year 2022, we'd be a little bit more like, you know, this isn't the best of metaphors. But for a biblical book, we can't judge them by modern standards. And so what Eicha does continuously is Yerushalayim as a woman. But specifically what we might call, you know, tropes or realities of the biblical era of women of particularly either weak status to convey the destruction side or being or endearment in order to contrast with what's been lost. And so the most obvious example of this is the opening verse, Eicha Yashva Vadad, you know, the lonely city, Ha'ir Rabati Am, it was once great with people, Hayataka Almana, it's a widow. Now, that widow is doing a few different things at once. This idea, the opening reference to Yerushalayim being an Almana, multiple things are being underscored by this comparison. First, a widow is, and you remember this from you know, every single verse in the Torah that addresses this, who are the weakest strata of society? The widows and orphans. Because especially in the biblical world, without a husband, you don't really have access to financial gain. So the widows are always historically the most poor. The the analogy nowadays, if you were trying to reach for this same analogy, you would think of a homeless person on the street. Like, that's a widow. When biblical imagery invokes a widow, part of it is the modern day homeless person on the street, because that was the widow, the beggar. They have no money. They have nothing. They're unfortunately the bottom of society. They're kind of ignored. Again, the Torah, you know, this is a general rule, right? If everyone was noticing the plight of the widow and helping them, the Torah probably wouldn't need to mention it roughly 5,000 times. But the fact is that, you know, it's the same way we need to be reminded to give charity to the homeless, because our instinct when we see a homeless person is to ignore them and walk past them. So the widow, first of all, it's that simple imagery of the lowest strata of society. The second thing, not the best word I could have thought of, but the second thing being created by this image of the widow is obviously someone who has lost something. And that's obviously Yerushalayim. It's lost its Beit HaMikdash. It's lost its people. So it's not just the lower strata of society, but a widow is someone who once had something and now no longer has what they once had. And the third, and this is actually a really important theological point, is that a widow has lost their spouse through no fault of their own. And this is a really important point, because one of the most popular metaphors a lot of the Nevi'im use when protesting the people and foretelling the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash is basically, you know, you're having an affair against God, or you're acting like a prostitute. And all of these various images of unfaithfulness is usually the image. And it can be argued that that comes up a couple of times within Eicha. But what's really interesting about what Eicha does is that it lowers that. It doesn't really recognize, until the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, it was very much, you're unfaithful, Yerushalayim is unfaithful, you'll deserve what you get. But during actual Eicha itself, we abandon that theme, that idea, and instead go to, you know, this is happening, there's no fault here. And that's a very powerful, if you're reading a lot of the other Nevi'im prophesying the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, if you're obviously a Jewish person going through the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and now you're hearing Eicha, this is a tremendous about turn. And so widow is not just conveying lower strata of society who lost something they once had, but the third thing it's doing is also shifting the perspective away from fault, unfaithfulness, those sorts of things, and instead to lost through no fault of your own. Another major image that we get is this word Bat Zion in the, for instance, it comes up quite a lot in Eicha, where we get the term Bat Zion as what's being downtrodden. So it's an interesting grammatical thing, which is, what does Bat Zion mean? Our instinctive translation is, it means daughter of Zion. You know, one of the classic examples is in the same. People argue, this is this comes from, by the way, I wouldn't necessarily recommend this for general reading, but this is like an academic commentary to Eicha, which, as you can imagine, leans heavily into the grammar of, you know, everything. But she has a whole long-winded discussion about what does Bat Zion mean. And people used to think it meant, here, I'll use the term, an appositional genitive. And obviously you all your appositional genitive self, so I don't probably need to explain anymore. But what I learned was Bat Zion people used to think is in the same way as city of Baltimore, you know, daughter of Zion. That's basically what it means. And in that sense, it's an interesting term, but what exactly is going on? So what Adele Billin argues and others have argued is no, we're missing the point. That Sion, and this is, and the reason I point this out is A, because it's a really frequently occurring word in Eicha, and B, it's one of the few phrases that we think we can translate ourselves, because Bat Zion, daughter of Zion. But what it actually means is crucially, there's a fundamental difference. It's not daughter of Zion, but daughter Zion. And there, the term daughter is not a literal term, but it's a term of endearment. In the same way that I call Kayla Princess Kayla, right? She's, you know, Yair gets really annoyed. She's not a princess. Why are you calling her? But like, the whole thing is, it's a term of endearment. It's not an official title. It's not an actual claim that she has some sort of throne somewhere. It's a term of endearment. Daughter Zion, it's taking a word that people have a natural affinity of endearment for. Children, daughters. Again, it's leaning into the female side of it, but it connotes a certain preciousness. And so Bat Zion means precious Zion, fair Zion. It's conveying, it's anthropomorphizing Zion as essentially a young girl, a daughter. And therefore we have, on the one hand, we have this tragic depiction of Yerushalayim as an almana, as a widow, but we also get this image of endearment, which on the one hand captures our love of Yerushalayim, but also amplifies the tragedy. Because if you personify, if you anthropomorphize Yerushalayim as a precious little girl, and now you're reading all the things happening, it's that bit more harrowing. It's the most evocative way you can do this kind of imagery. And so Bat Zion is a way of indicating the preciousness of Yerushalayim. And so as this word comes up over and over again, it's Eicha referring to Yerushalayim as with this really precious term, which again amplifies the trauma, and it amplifies just how harrowing this is when you're referring to something as this precious, gentle thing to take care of. It only makes its destruction even more harrowing. You know, if Yerushalayim was referred to as burly, strong, you know, builder, it would still be horrible to read about burly, strong builder being, you know, attacked, but you don't have, it doesn't evoke the same imagery as precious little girl, which is essentially what Eicha's doing. Precious little girl Yerushalayim being trampled on by soldiers. It's an extra additional level of imagery. And finally, the one other example here is, again, in the bold, Olaleha halchu shvi lifnei tsar. Her infants have gone into captivity. Yerushalayim here is a mother. So what Eicha's doing is, again, think of it, it's picking up whichever image hits the hardest. So if you imagine Eicha as a widow, you think of it as downtrodden, having lost. If you picture it as a mother, now you get this idea of just how much trauma Yerushalayim is going through, experiencing, watching its people be destroyed. Right now, these are her children. So that ratchets up. And again, as we are actually reading in Eicha about mothers losing their children, you obviously get that parallel. And then finally, Eicha picks up this precious little girl motif when it wants to focus on not the experience Yerushalayim is reflecting on, but the experience Yerushalayim is going through. It picks up this metaphor instead. So Yerushalayim in Eicha is always a woman. And that woman is either a downtrodden woman, a precious, you know, little girl, or a mother, in order to, you know, build off those themes. Eicha is carefully crafted and brilliantly so. It's not subtle. It's not pretending to be subtle. You don't need to be when you're Eicha, but therefore it just picks up the metaphors, you know, with abandon and drops them again. we want to use this one for these next three verses because that's going to hit the hardest. And now we're going to pick up these ones and use these ones because they're hit the hardest. That's what it's doing the entire time. The one other thing I want to, I said the female thing was the final thing, but I realized there's one other thing. And that is chapter three. Chapter three is different in every single way. And it's just very short. The verses, and it begins, Ani Hogever. I am the man, Ra'a Ani, who has seen affliction, Beshevet Evrata, under the rod of his wrath. Chapter three is about actually witnessing the destruction. So it shifts perspective completely, and you enter behind the eyes of the writer of chapter three. What's really cool about chapter three, and I don't want to dwell on this at any length now, but I do just want to draw your attention to, it has a very different theme. The best example of this being verse 10. Dov orev huli. It's talking about God. God is a lurking bear. Ariba mistarim, a lion waiting in ambush. What chapter three does, and it's interesting because again, we get chapter one, two, destruction, chapters four, five, destruction, chapter three in the middle, has a really interesting theological take where it seems to have, exhibits frustration with God for Eicha taking place. And it's, again, it's a discussion I just want to raise without discussing in any way, but it's a really fascinating thing Eicha does, because it confronts the theology of the experience of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, but it doesn't, again, it's not pulling its punches. It's really directly confronting the fact of, where is God during this? Why is God punishing me? God seems to me in this moment during Eicha like a lion trying to kill me. Those are not positive images that we usually associate with Tanakh. But it's another fascinating example of how Eicha does a lot. And so much of it is with its poetry and imagery, but it also uses, especially in chapter three, it uses itself as an opportunity to raise some really, you know, complicated and delicate theological questions directly prompted by the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. And so, you know, please God, next week we'll once again talk a little bit more about the way Eicha is crafted in a few different ways. But hopefully already, these are just a few different small examples of how, when we are sat on Tisha B'Av night hearing Eicha, following along, listening to Eicha, we'll be able to better appreciate some of the images, the sounds, and the poetic devices going on within Eicha to better appreciate the trauma that we are supposed to be re-experiencing as we read Eicha.